Now, this question of the symbolism whereby a soul, the soul of the mystic, is represented by two characters, in this case Imogen and her father, can be called alchemical, because the transformation from base metals into gold is only possible in virtue of the fact that the true essence of lead and other such metals is gold. In Cymbeline, it is the father who represents the base metal and the daughter the potential gold. This symbolism is much more in evidence in The Tempest, which is Shakespeare's truly alchemical play. And here it is father and child who represent respect, it is also father and child who represent respectively the lead and the gold. That is, King Alonso represents the lead and Prince Ferdinand the potential gold. And the two have always, in both cases, have first of all to be separated. That is why Imogen has to leave the court, and why her counterpart in The Tempest, Prince Ferdinand, has to be separated from his father in the shipwreck. But one symbolism can strengthen another. And in both these plays, as in others, Shakespeare uses also the symbolism of marriage, wherein one of the lovers personifies the soul and the other the spirit. In this case, of course, the lover, it is only one person who personifies the soul, not two. And in this play, that is that one person's Imogen. But the significance in most cases is reversible. That is, it can be that each of the lovers can be said to symbolize the soul, and each can be said to symbolize the spirit. But in three cases, it is not reversible. That is, in Othello, The Winter's Tale, and King Lear. Although the relationship in King Lear is different, it is not that of love, it's not a symbolism of marriage, but it's a symbolism of devotion, and it is Cordelia always who represents the spirit, King Lear the soul. That is not reversible. But in The Winter's Tale, Hermione is definitely the spirit. Her husband, Leontes, is the mystic, passing through the mysteries, the soul in search of perfection. And the third is Desdemona, who, that's why the play has a single name, Othello. It's not called Othello and Desdemona, like Romeo and Juliet or Antony and Cleopatra. It's called Othello, because Desdemona is the spirit. There's no question of that. And Othello is the soul. But in the other plays, there is, and in Cymbeline also, this relationship is reversible. If the husband stands for every man, that is the mystic soul in quest of union with the spirit, then it is the wife who personifies the spirit. But where the plot of a play allows it, the same wife can also be seen as the soul that has to pass through the mysteries, in which case the husband will stand for the spirit. At this point, let it be remembered that symbolism is in the nature of things. And what we have said, what we've just said, illustrates this, since in all true love, there must be an element of worship. For Romeo, Juliet is the sun. Her hand is a holy shrine. She is a saint, and he a pilgrim. And for her part, Juliet says to Romeo, when there is a question of an oath, "But if thou wilt swear by thy gentle self that art the god of my idolatry, and I will believe thee." So far in this play, we have only considered Imogen as the pilgrim. From this point of view, Imogen likens Posthumus to an eagle. He is also named Leonatus, the lion's whelp. The eagle and the lion being the bird and beast of the sun, which is the great symbol of the spirit. Imogen protests to her father at the beginning of the play that although she is a princess and he a commoner, there is no common measure between them, he being far more excellent than she is. But Posthumus likewise stands for the soul, which has to pass through the narrow gate of death. And from this point of view, it is the princess Imogen who represents the spirit. I have to mention now something which I didn't mention at the time, that when Imogen is waking up from the sleeping draught, she finds beside her the dead body of Cloten, but dressed in the clothes belong which Pisanio had got for him, clothes belonging to Posthumus. And his head has been cut off so that he is unrecognizable. She thinks it is Posthumus' dead body, her husband's dead body, and she assumes him to be dead from that moment. But this is, by the way, from what we're considering now. I'm talking about the question of Posthumus himself, who is certainly not dead, representing the soul on its way through the lesser mysteries, and Imogen, the princess, representing the spirit. And the last act of the play opens with Posthumus alone on the stage in the Roman camp in Britain, where he has come together with the Italian gentry who have been roped into the war because the Roman army is busy elsewhere, fighting elsewhere, and they have been, a lot of the gentry have been brought into the host to come against Britain to extract the tribute. A campaign which is not considered by Rome to be of much difficulty or importance. And Posthumus, of course, has heard that Imogen is dead. And realizing that he still loves her despite her supposed infidelity to him, bitterly repents having ordered her death. He takes off now his Italian clothes and dresses like a British peasant, intending to change sides and fight for Britain. "For thee, O Imogen," he says, "so I'll die for thee, O Imogen, even for whom my life is every breath a death." He wants nothing but death, in fact, just as she, for her part, begged Pisano to carry out his master's orders and kill her. The battle begins, and in a skirmish between Iachimo and the disguised Posthumus. Iachimo is overcome and disarmed. The humiliation, because Prospero has disguised himself as a British peasant, the humiliation of being vanquished by a mere British peasant is so great that Iachimo says is the heaviness and guilt within my bosom takes off my manhood. I have belied a lady, the princess of this country, and the air on it revengingly enfeebles me. He retreats, but nonetheless the battle at first goes in favor of the Romans. The Britons are put to flight, and Cymbeline is taken prisoner. Then suddenly the Lord Bellarius enters with Cymbeline's two sons, and they shout to the Britons, "Stand, stand," and their words bring them to check their flight. In fact, speaking of it, it's said in the text that after the battle, many people thought that these two young men were angels. And they compel the Britons to make a stand. And Posthumus joins them. Cymbeline is rescued, and the Romans are routed, and many taken prisoner. Posthumus himself, having failed to find death in the battle, rejoins the Romans as a prisoner, hoping to find death in that way. And in prison, he has a dream of his parents and brothers praying to Jupiter on his behalf. And then Jupiter himself descends and reassures the spirits, bidding them return to Elysium. And he leaves a cryptic inscription which Posthumus finds when he wakes. And Posthumus is now released from prison because it comes to the king's ears that he must be the man, one of those men who rescued him. And Posthumus is brought into the king's presence. Lucius pleads with Cymbeline that his page is innocent and must not be put to death, because there's a question of putting all the prisoners to death. Although, as Lucius says, if we had won the battle, if we Romans had won the battle, we would not have put our captives to the sword. And when Cymbeline is asked to pardon the page, he immediately takes a liking to his disguised daughter, and he takes her as his page himself. And she then asks him a favor. If she may question, she sees Iachimo in front of her among the prisoners. If she may question that man about the diamond ring he is wearing, which she recognizes as the one she gave to Posthumus. Iachimo then comes forward. He's already, as we've seen, overcome with a sense of guilt. And he confesses everything. It is then that Posthumus reveals himself and says and cries out, "Oh, give me cord or knife or poison, some upright justicer. Thou king, send out for torturers ingenious. It is I that all the abhorrent things on earth amend by being worse than they. Everything horrible on the earth I make seem good compared with me." And then, of course, Imogen comes to realize that this is the husband, he's still alive, not dead as she thought. She comes to embrace him, and he thinks he doesn't understand what this young man is about, and he strikes her to the ground. And then Pisanio comes forward and reveals who it is. Imogen is not her, but so that they are united once more. And then the question of the queen and her son comes up. And Valerius and the two boys, the two young men, the sons of Cymbeline standing there, Guiderius and Valerius. And Guiderius says about Clotan, "I killed him." And the king, who is prepared to load them with honors because they say to him, says, "In that case, you must die." He was a prince. You cannot kill such a person with impunity. He's very sorrowful at this. Then Valerius intervenes, and finally it comes out he's forced to tell Cymbeline that these are his two sons. And there is, of course, a general rejoicing. Cymbeline says to Imogen, "You have lost by this a kingdom." She replies, "I have gained by this two worlds." And the audience begins to realize that without any explanation, we are suddenly on a higher plane. We are at the plane of the greater mysteries, as it were. The threshold has been crossed. There is such amazing happiness. You consider all the things which have come together suddenly. Imogen realizes that these two men, these two young men she loved, she has such a spontaneous love for, are in fact her brothers. They realize that she, whom they loved, is in fact their sister. And it's perhaps this extraordinary happiness which prevails is perhaps best summed up by the words of Cymbeline himself. At the end, he looks round and says, "See, Posthumus anchors upon Imogen, and she, like harmless lightning, throws her eye on him, her brothers, me, her master, that is Lucius, hitting each object with a joy. The counterchange is severally in all. Let's quit this ground and smoke the temple with our sacrifices." And then he turns to Valerius and says, "Thou art my brother. so we'll hold thee ever. And one has to admit, it seems to me, that it is precisely the anagogical meaning, the highest meaning of all, which takes over, suddenly taken over, as it were, surreptitiously taken over from the literal meaning, to produce this extraordinary effect. This is one of the most moving scenes in all Shakespeare's plays, this final scene. The extraordinary happiness of after great suffering that has taken place throughout the play in many respects, the recovery of things which were believed to be irretrievably lost. That happiness is a characteristic of The Winter's Tale and of The Tempest. It's possibly more intense in this play than in those. It is not necessarily greater, but I think I would say that it is in Cymbeline that Shakespeare expresses more than any other play something of the truth, that he's bent on expressing this, though not necessarily. I don't know whether he knew of St. Julian of Norwich, what was said to her by Christ, but all shall be well. And then he added, to make quite sure that she accepted, all manner of things shall be well, referring to the reality which will prevail ultimately. No, I don't know if there's anyone got any questions. I don't think I can say any more than I have said. Yes.
I have two.
Yes.
I'm worthy of asking, but what is, when you say that, for example, Othello represents the soul and is the one with the spirit, what do you mean by that?
Well, Desdemona she's referred to throughout the play as the divine Desdemona. Very often the word divine is applied to her. And she has no faults. Othello has the fault of not having enough faith in his wife's goodness, of listening to Iago, who clearly represents the devil, is out. Othello also develops throughout the play. Just a moment, there's no development in the character. She doesn't need any development.
So, what is the difference between the soul and the spirit?
What is the difference between the soul and the spirit?
Soul and the spirit in that sense.
Well, what is the difference between the soul and the spirit? The spirit only spirits can be in paradise. The spirit belongs to the next world. The soul is a prolongation of the spirit, and it is reabsorbed into the spirit in the end. The soul, this world, is the world of soul and body. The next world is the world of spirits. The spirit is also has a divine aspect. There is the creative spirit, and there is the third person of the Christian Trinity. The Holy Ghost is spirit. Spirit has a created aspect and an uncreated aspect. But it is transcendent as regards this world. Spirit is not at home in this world. The other characters in Shakespeare, for example, King Duncan in Macbeth, represents spirit clearly. But I don't know if I've answered your question.
Yes, you have.
What was the other question?
Well, two little ones. One is that when you say Othello is a single person instead of a, you know, Romeo and Juliet, Antony and Cleopatra, but Macbeth also is a single person. Not Macbeth.
Macbeth is very different from the other great plays. You really cannot. Most of what I've said tonight doesn't apply to Macbeth. It is a kind of. It's a very difficult point. You have to read my chapter on Macbeth to see the difference, because it's too. I can't go into that question now. But you see, Macbeth is not a mystic, he's the protagonist. But he's on his way to hell, not on his way through purgatory to paradise, quite clearly.
Also, I wanted to ask, perhaps it's a primitive question, but what are the lesser mysteries and the higher mysteries?
What is?
The lesser mysteries and the greater mysteries.
The letter which Jupiter?
The lesser mysteries and the greater mysteries.
The lesser mysteries and the greater mysteries. Well, the lesser mysteries are concerned with the coming to know one's faults and purification from faults. The greater mysteries are the ascent through the different degrees of paradise, the different spiritual degrees to the ultimate spiritual summit, the divine presence itself. That is the lesson, but that is the greater mysteries. The lesser mysteries, which are more suitable for drama, are concerned with getting to know one's faults, that is, the descent into hell, and purification from those faults. Well, perhaps that's... Yes,
how many of Shakespeare's audience would have appreciated the symbolism?
Well, one appreciates symbolism without realizing it. One feels as conscious of the depth, which one doesn't necessarily understand. There's so many different degrees. But I think almost anybody would feel in symbolism that there's something more to this than we can understand. When they've been through that last scene, I think many of them would see the likeness between the two brothers and the heavenly twins, Castor and Pollux, because they speak. Someone says in that they are fit to inlay the heaven with stars, which is what Castor and Pollux are representatives as having become. And they are considered that people after the battle, people are saying, could they be angels? Could they have been angels? It's so miraculous, the effect of their presence. And the very fact that they have come out, they are in the king's presence, has changed him. I mean, he is transformed. His wife cannot stand their presence. She cannot maintain, now that they have come to the court, the two brothers, they have returned to their father. He has regained his original nature. They cannot, she cannot, has no influence upon them. I can't answer your question any other way. There are different degrees of understanding.
And thank you again for your influence.
Thank you.